So, yeah, that was my thing for today. But, so it's kind of, weird that, not weird, it's, you know, people have talked to me about going through Daniel. I've been, honestly, a little reluctant because I feel it's, like, little deeper water than I can swim in. And but as we just happen to be here in this scripture, going through this in our, it happens to tie back to Daniel very, very deeply. So, you know, we'll pray about that. And if the Lord leads us there, we'll plunge in. But, again, I feel inadequate to, you know, facilitate how that, the book of Daniel, but if that's where people want to go, that's what we'll plunge into. But
I just have one thing like to say about that, though.
Go ahead, Forrest. That's all I'll say about that.
Many people are trying to pinpoint exact times, and everybody gets worried because we see the way the world's going and all this stuff, and we know it's getting closer. The birth pangs are getting deeper, and all this stuff. But it's very clear in Scripture; it's not for us to know. And that's the most important. I mean, we have clues. We can look at these things and see. But not to say I love going through Daniel. It's fun.
It does say somewhere around 2,000 years, though.
We don't know the day or the hour.
Right. We're past 2,000.
So, like, there's been many conjectures, many ideas. Here's the reality is Christ is here and alive today.
Yeah.
And the temple is you.
Yeah. I like that.
Right. So we're not looking, yes, we're looking for his coming, but I'm not waiting for him to call me up. So a lot of times we get, when's it happen? I'm like, we're not the next.
Yeah, the remnant has to happen first.
Well, and part of the fun is, and part of what I am trying to enjoy going through this, we are the temple now, right? Temple's gone. Everything that we said. So, all the implements that God created for worship in the temple are in us. So, all the lavers, all the everything had a purpose, and that purpose is in us now. And that's what we're going. That's where we're headed to, is the usefulness of this. Because the temple. Think about this. So, in my mind, I'm trying to go through why the temple. So God built this amazing, huge, unbelievable structure in the middle of a podunk little place in the middle of the Mideast, right, in the desert. But his point was for people to see this and be drawn to him through his people. They failed, right? So you're trying to wrap your head around this. So they build it, they come back later, they build another temple. Well, it's not as grandiose as this. So the question is, so God just says, to me, he was speaking, saying, I want your life to draw people, and it will. But you'll fail. And some of those people, so then you have to come back, and now people are used to seeing you as a, you know, you were the wild man out doing all this stuff. Now you got saved. You're this great temple on the hill. You fail, right? So now you're like, he comes back to you. He renews you. But now you don't need to be, you're not that super duper thing on the hill. You're just living your life the best that he has empowered you to do. And it doesn't have to be this grandiose. And they cried about it. If you'll go through when the shortest guy in the Bible, another joke,
Nehemiah,
he rebuilt the temple, right? And it was
filled out the shoebox.
So, but you know, they cried over it. But God, it wasn't important to God the look of the temple. It's always about a heart issue. How do you approach the sacrifice of your life and the worship and all? Doesn't matter where. And think about it now. I mean, you know, if you're into Judaism and you understand, and they've kind of made rules to get around, you know, the Bible says without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission of sin. So I don't know how so kind of Judaism has morphed into this more works-based kind of thing, because obviously they can't offer sacrifices at this point. But that's not important to God now. It's all about the heart issue, and that's what this is going to point to. But it's kind of interesting, if we can get this video to play, and I'm yapping on, that the show, the flow of the worship in the temple was important. I don't know if I ever remember hearing that or whatnot, but I didn't think about it till, which I think we're going to find interesting in the video. And you can, again, it's all conjecture, but I think it's a really neat point, and we'll see it when we get there. So that was Chris's divulging into Lord knows where. All right, verse 5. Against the walls of the main hall in the inner sanctuary, he built a structure around the building in which there were side rooms. The lowest floor was 5 cubits wide, the middle floor was 6 cubits, and the third floor was 7. He made offset ledges around the outside of the temple so that nothing would be inserted into the temple wall. Basically, he made ledges, if you understand this, and you'll see it in the video if it plays, going up so that they could build the first floor to set. No poles protruded into the church or into the sanctuary to support these floors. So they made a ledge that they could put timbers across, and then put supports on the outside, and they had floors. They had 3 floors. But he wanted nothing to go through the walls of the temple. So that'll become a thing in our personal life. In building the temple, the only blocks dressed at the quarry were used, and no hammer, chisel, or any other iron tool was heard at the temple site while it was being built. So there's the thing. So all the work that was going on in the temple was done somewhere else. It remained a reverent and holy site through the building process. The entrance to the lowest floor was on the south side of the temple. A stairway led up to the middle level, and from there to the third. So he built the temple and completed it, roofing it with beams and cedar planks. And he built the side rooms all along the temple. The height of each was 5 cubits, and they were attached to the temple by beams of cedar. And the word of the Lord came to Solomon. And again, when I was always reading this before, I always just said, the word of the Lord. Okay, something spoke to him. But what does John, verse 1, say?
The word was with God, and the word was God.
So I actually take this now, and it says, and the word of the Lord came to Solomon. I could picture in my mind Jesus came and had a talk.
And it's capital, so that's Yahweh.
Yeah. As for this temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, observe my laws, and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you a promise I gave to David your father, and I will live among the Israelites, and you will not abandon my people Israel. And I will not abandon my people Israel. So Solomon built the temple and completed it. He lined its interior walls with cedar boards, paneling them from floor of the temple to the ceiling, and covering the floor of the temple with planks of juniper. He partitioned off 20 cubits at the rear of the temple with cedar boards from floor to ceiling to form within the temple an inner sanctuary, the most holy place. The main hall in front of this room was 40 cubits long. The inside of the temple was cedar, carved with gourds and open flowers. Everything was cedar, and no stone was to be seen. He prepared the inner sanctuary with the temple to set the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord there. It's kind of interesting. I always take it that the temple inside where God met his people was organic material. It was organic. The outside was where the hard hearts were. The stones were outside, on the outside. Where he met his people was soft, and it was pliable, and yes, and it smelled, and it and cedar, you know, protects against rot and all those kind of things. So I think it's kind of neat that you think about all the planning and all the thought that's in this. You know, the Lord just didn't say, hey, build everything out of stone and we're good. Let's get this done quick.
He provided the material.
Yep. So, and it's organic. Yep. Where the Lord meets you is organic. He doesn't want the hard, he's got to penetrate the hard stones to get to the organic material. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 wide, and 20 high. He overlaid the inside with pure gold, and he also overlaid the altar of cedar. Man, that's a lot of gold. Solomon covered the inside of the temple with pure gold, and he extended gold chains across to the front of the inner sanctuary, which was overlaid with gold. So he overlaid the whole interior with gold. He also overlaid with gold the altar that belongs to the inner sanctuary. For the inner sanctuary, he made a pair of cherubim out of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. One wing of the first cherub was 5 cubits long. The other wing was 5 cubits. 10 cubits from wingtip to wingtip. A second cherub was also measured 10 cubits, for the two cherubim were identical in size and shape, and the height of each cherub was 10 cubits. He placed the cherub inside the innermost room of the temple with their wings spread out, and the wings of one cherub touched one wall while the wing of the other touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room, and he overlaid the cherubim with gold. So what does gold speak of?
Royalty
and majesty. So he built it out of organic material, but he took royalty and placed it on that organic material. And that is the opportunity that we all have. I mean, we talk about it quickly sometimes, and I don't think it would understand what it means to be a son and daughter of God. I mean, I always picture Jerusalem, well, let's say 60 AD, and then we'll go a little further, a little sooner than that, 20 AD. You have four Roman soldiers, walking down a back alley in Jerusalem. What keeps, you know, there's a couple million Jews living in Jerusalem, or maybe not a couple million, but a couple hundred thousand, a couple thousand. What keeps those four soldiers safe? The fact that if you do anything to those four soldiers, the weight of the Roman Empire is going to pile down on your head, and you're going to find yourself nailed to a tree outside the city gates for a couple days while you slowly die. So when you become a son and daughter of God, you're offered that protection of the guy that runs the universe and maybe things we can't even comprehend is on your side, right? The weight of that, and the only thing that can attack you are things, or I should say defeat you. Anything can attack you. The only thing that can defeat you is the things you allow, because you have an unbelievable power behind you, 10 times, a billion times greater than the Roman Empire, with you just walking down the street. So I just think it's just awesome that he took this organic material and laid gold on everything, made it all divine, made it all, now it's worth, we have a saying, worth its weight in gold, and that's what you are, right? So I think it's just a really cool, and then the cherubim, you know, obviously they're in the sanctuary, so these are the things that minister right at the altar of God, and it's a picture of heaven is what's being built here. So these are the same beings that we're going to, all throughout the Bible, you'll see when people have glimpses of the throne room of God, you see the cherub there, you know, praising God and protecting his holiness. Then there's the seraphim, the fiery serpents. You know, it's got to be a pretty awesome place. And again, we go back when we talked about last time, we talked about the little, you know, how modern paintings and the Renaissance made them these little chubby babies with wings, and these are mighty, mighty beasts or beings that, you know, one evening killed 200,000 Assyrians. So he isn't a little chubby guy, you know, a 6-month-old in a diaper with a
badass.
Yeah. So, you know, they are not what we have created. So let me.
So what's the difference between cherubim and an angel?
Well, I think they are angels. Angels are angel means messenger. So I believe what we call angels is just, there's different levels of what, like I said, so we know that seraphim are these fiery angels in the throne room of God. They're also an angel, but they're a type of angel. And then a cherub would be another angel. So one of them protects the holiness of God. One of them's going, holy, 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 or, you know, so they are controlling the holiness of God at the throne room of God. Then the cherubim there, and they have a specific, but God has angels that we see throughout the Bible that have, you know, one come talk to Mary and, you know, told. So he was literally the messenger of God. And that's what Angelos, the Greek and all in the Hebrew, just means messenger of God. But I think there's different rankings, just like when Paul said there's, you know, principalities, powers, and all. I think he was ranking the other team, and then there's a ranking on the, because obviously Michael contended with Satan, and there, I don't think you see that anywhere else than anything other than that God contends with Satan.
Even called
the yeah. Yeah. So, and then, you know, back to Daniel, we see the thing where the one angel said, hey, 21 days ago God sent me here, but I was opposed, and Michael, your guardian, had to come fight my battle for me to bring this message through. So we see this weird, and he fought against, well, what's interesting is he fought against the Prince of Persia. Persia didn't even exist as an empire at the time. So there's a realm behind us that we know nothing kind of about other than these little glimpses we get. So, on the walls around the temple, in both the inner and outer rooms, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. He also covered the floors of both the inner and outer room of the temple with gold. For the entrance to the inner sanctuary, he made doors out of olive wood that were one-fifth the width of the sanctuary. And on the two olive wood doors, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, overlaid the cherubim and palm trees with hammered gold. In the same way, for the entrance to the main hall, he made door frames out of olive wood that were one-fourth the width of hall. He also made two doors out of juniper wood, each having two leaves that turned in sockets. He carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flower on them, overlaid them with gold, hammered them evenly over the carvings. He built the inner courtyard of three courses of dressed stone and one course of trimmed cedar beams. And the foundation of the temple of the Lord was laid in the fourth year in the month of Ziv, and in the 11th year in the month of Bul, the 8th month, the temple was finished in all its details according to its specifications. He had spent 7 years building it. So we're back to the number of completion is 7. So it's kind of interesting that the Bible always keeps a the same things through it. So this goes off into another thing, so I was going to wait to go into the next. I was going to play the video. What's up, Ann?
I have a quick little note on cherubim and seraphim. It says that the cherubim are spiritual beings that what did it say? Spiritual beings between guardian heaven. You can see that the cherubim are guardians between heaven and earth. And then it says the seraphim, it says, has six wings instead of two or four wings, as mentioned in Isaiah chapter 6. And they are described with a similar role as the cherubim, with some variation. Just a little side note.
Thank you. So, feel free. We are going to try to do this because I think the video is really, really cool. And so discuss amongst yourself. There'll be a quiz. How big was the inner sanctuary? How many blocks did they use? And could the priest wear Wranglers?
Very specific.
No.
They had to have Levi jeans.
Oh, he had to get it in the cookie.
From the Amish.
See if it works better than sex.
Sugar boots.
It says the cherubim are also apparently have to do with the holiness of God as violated by sin, the seraphim with uncleanness of the people of God.
Alright,
say that
again.
So the cherubim apparently have to do with the holiness of God as violated by sin, whereas the seraphim with uncleanness in the people of God. It's referred to apparently in Isaiah 6:2.
Isaiah 6:2?
There's nothing to be identical with the seraphim.
And in, I'll add to that in Genesis.
Do I do a 5G or just the saving grace?
When he drove man out of the garden, it was cherubim at the east of the garden.
Cherubim.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Keeping that holiness separate from.
Are we seeing anything?
Fuzz, black, purple.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I have a brand.
Do you know just like what number you're plugged into?
Two. HDMI 2. Two should be the number. And the number shall be 2.
Got that far.
Time to
make
the
bacon,
both of you.
A lot of coffee. Oh, my goodness. I wonder if Michael could do such a thing, huh?
What's that?
You normally like
this? Yeah. Anybody else?
And you said,
that was said about what the bacon was?
Normal. Oh, yeah.
Understanding the significance of its location, history, and design can greatly add to one's reverence for one of the most
famous cities in the world.
The city of Jerusalem is located in an area of three major valleys, the Hinnom, the central or Cambrian, and the Kidron Valley. The mountain range between the central and Kidron Valley is called Mount Moriah. The peak of the mountain is a large, protruding, flat rock, which is now located under the Dome of the Rock. According to Genesis 22:2, Abraham was commanded to sacrifice Isaac in the region of Moriah, connecting the Temple Mount with this significant event. At the time of King David, the area of Jerusalem was controlled by the Jebusites, the city only occupying the southern part of the central ridge. When David captured the city in about 1000 BC, he made Jerusalem his capital. David then moved the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem and began preparations for building a permanent structure to replace the portable tabernacle of Moses that had been used for over 400 years. With the ancient city of Jerusalem being fairly small, David purchased the threshing floor of Arona the Jebusite so he could expand the size of the city. Being higher than the city of David, the hilltop would make a beautiful place to build the temple of the Lord. Under the reign of David's son, King Solomon, the temple construction began. After 7 years of construction in about 960 BC, Solomon finished building the temple, most likely built over the same protruding rock of Mount Moriah. Solomon also built himself a new palace just south of the temple and expanded the walls of the city up towards the peak of Mount Moriah. The Temple of Solomon was modeled after the Tabernacle of Moses. Because of the many similarities between the Tabernacle and the Garden of Eden, many scholars believe that the Garden of Eden was the prototype for the Tabernacle, and thus later temples. According to Jewish tradition, Eden was located on a hill, with the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil at the center of the hill. The Bible teaches that when Adam and Eve transgressed and partook of the forbidden fruit, they were cast out towards the east. Cherubim and a flaming sword were then placed at the east entrance to prevent them from partaking of the tree of life, as they would then live forever in their sin. In order to return back into the presence of God, Israel had to symbolically retrace the steps of Adam and Eve, passing the cherubim and re-entering the garden in a westward direction. The tabernacle was set up in the same east-to-west progression, seeming to replicate the Garden of Eden. The tabernacle was divided into three main courts, the outer court, the holy place, and the Holy of Holies. The outer court represented the fallen world, while the inner courts represented a more sacred and holier way of life. In essence, as the priest, who represented represented all of Israel, progressed through the tabernacle, or temple, he left the world to enter a more holy state, and then was enabled to re-enter the presence of the Lord, passing the angels, or cherubim, who were embroidered on the veil. Solomon's temple replicated the same three-level progression, doubling the floor plan size of the tabernacle sanctuary for the temple structure. As one approached the Temple of Solomon, the first thing noticed was the brazen altar of sacrifice. The altar was 20 cubits long and wide and 10 cubits high, a cubit being the length from the elbow to the tip of the longest finger, or about 1.5 feet. On the four corners of the altar were four horns, horns often representing power. This is where the sacrificial animals were burned, representing the future sacrifice of the Savior Jesus Christ. On the southeast side of the temple was the molten or brazen sea, which rested on the backs of 12 oxen, three pointing in each of the cardinal directions. In ancient times, oxen represented strength, and the number 12 often represented the 12 tribes of Israel. Water from the larger brazen sea was poured into 10 bronze water basins on both sides of the temple, which could then be wheeled around the outer court for various washing and cleansing rituals by the priests. Around the south, west, and north sides of the temple were three floors of chambers or storage rooms. The inside wall of the chambers was stepped
to create
a ledge where the timbers of the floors could rest. The storage rooms were accessed by a door on the south side of the temple, with wooden ladders going up into each of the floors. At the front of the temple were two large bronze pillars that flanked the porch. The pillar on the left was named Boaz, and the pillar on the right was named Jachin. The tops were decorated with lily flower petals and pomegranates. Pomegranates were a sign of prosperity and posterity because of their many seeds, and were also found on the bottom hem of the clothing of the high priest. The main temple doors were made of two large bifolding doors covered in gold with cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. The Bible describes the door frame as being a fourth part of the wall, which most scholars believe means that the door had four stepped frames. The interior doorway of the Holy of Holies was similar, except having five frames instead of four. The priests, who represented Israel, were the only ones allowed into the inner temple. This means that Israel only could enter through being represented by the priests. Once you entered the main doors, you entered the holy place, a large room 40 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 30 cubits tall. The room was overlaid with gold and decorated with cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, possibly alluding to the beauty of the Garden of Eden. The room was lit by 10 large menorahs, five on each side of the room, that were constantly burning, and narrow windows on each side of the top of the room. On the right side of the room was located the table of showbread, which had 12 large flat pita-like loaves. The priests ate and then replaced the showbread every Sabbath, similar to our weekly partaking of the communion or sacramental bread. Breaking bread and sharing a meal with someone in ancient times represented that you were at peace with them and was a sign of brotherhood, love, and forgiveness. Directly in front of the Holy of Holies was the altar of incense. The altar was similar to the altar of sacrifice in that it had a square footprint, and also had four horns, one on each of the corners. However, on the altar of sacrifice was burned the flesh of animals, while upon the altar of incense burned a sweet combination of incenses. The incense burning before the veil of the temple represented the prayers of the saints ascending to God before the veil, a reminder that before we can enter God's presence, our lives, prayers, and actions must become a sweet savor unto the Lord. Only the high priest was able to enter the Holy of Holies, and only on one day a year, the Day of Atonement. Before entering, the high priest passed through a beautifully embroidered veil woven from purple, red, blue, and white threads. The colors were the same as used in the ephod and breastplate of the clothing of the high priest, minus the gold thread. Embroidered on the veil were cherubim, who symbolically guarded the dwelling place of God. as the high priest passed through the veil, he had to pass these angels, who, like in the Garden of Eden, guarded the way back to the presence of the Lord. Upon entering the Holy of Holies, you would find that the room is in the shape of a perfect cube, being 20 cubits wide, long, and tall. The walls were likewise overlaid with gold and decorated with cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. Two large cherubim flanked the Ark of the Covenant, which was in the center of the room, with their wings stretching from one side of the room to the other. This room is where the presence of the Lord would dwell, and represented the final goal and destiny of all Israel. Solomon's temple was not only a landmark for the city of Jerusalem, but more importantly, the dwelling place of the Lord. The layout represented Israel's progression back into God's presence and was designed to teach Israel that it was only through the infinite sacrifice of the sinless Messiah that they could once again enjoy the presence of the Lord. A sacrifice that would be performed on a cross only a short distance from this holy mountain.
The new seraphim
look
like lion people.
Seraphim looks like...
I mean,
look
cherubim
look
like
lion.
Like
Egypt,
yes.
Yep. Seraphim
look
like a serpent.
Seraphim
look
like
serpent?
Mm-hmm. That's why you think they conjectured Satan might have been...
looking like that?
Well, he might have been a...
I feel
a Catholic song coming upon me. We're cherubim.
The Temple of Jerusalem that stood at the time of Jesus, rebuilt by Herod the Great, stands as one of history's greatest
structures.
And the largest temple
Do your own research.
Has never seen
They're just on YouTube and
Take me past the hours.
Solomon's Temple Explained. It's just a YouTube.
Hey, you don't like
Solomon's Temple Explained by Chris Simmons.
Yeah, I could tell you.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like Chris.
I don't know, Chris kind of looks like Moses.
Well, he was sitting up there with his
part
the way
now
with his voice.
I barely parked the water in the shower this morning.
Great job.
10 minutes and 21 seconds.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So what did Kent say?
Kent?
He says I'm overthinking it.
You fill the block with Kent again, but put rebar just for like a retaining wall. So he's not even a block, but he's regular block. It's cheaper.
I can remember
that. But grout block strength anyway. And he says you pour the slab on top of it, and I say, yeah, I'm going to have rebar.
Turn it. You're overthinking. It's going to happen.
I said, well, and sure, it's not after stair, but it's the back of
the
stair. You're good. You know, you got it, what you're doing.
Yeah. And many people
he answered my question very well. He says, yes. He says, you're 5 foot tall of exposed wall. That'll retain it. He says, if you go, you're using a 12 inch block, you can go 10 foot for foundation. And it's not grout, it's not the whole pressure of dirt. So, that makes some sense to do that. So.
Cool, good.
Yeah, and answer. It's just like I thought. I thought it was overkill. You know, that you were here, so we know issues. But the thing is, it's the worst part of oil pressure is during construction. Because when you backfill something, there's more pressure.
I remember that first. I remember years ago.
When a bunch of berries go against you, I call it pressure, which is scary. But when exactly you got everything tied together, during construction,
pressure,
everything you hold together, got to hold it in.
Right. Yes, he answered the question. He said, yeah, that's
but I was looking through my resistance.
So that was an interference thing. I wasn't sure that was going to work. And I actually, Mom was going to do everything yesterday.
I tried to talk you into going to the Extraordinary Women next weekend with Sister Pam.
Yeah,
and your niece Samantha.
Well, we're having
party?
Teresa's going to, Teresa and Steve leave for
Hawaii.
Hawaii.
Go to
Korea.
South Korea.
Yeah. Cool.